Welcome to episode 10 and the season finale of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph, who's getting very excited about the use of the word finale.
Yeah, that's right.
It sounds so cinematic.
Well, it really is. I mean, this is our season one finale. There will be a season two.
And we're very excited.
Absolutely. And thank you for listening. So tonight, we're doing an ode to cinema.
And it's a bit of a pun there, because I love puns, because all these films that we chose tonight, all three of them, for some reason, all end in the sound O. So it's our ode to cinema, if you will.
So the first film we'll be talking about is The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Get it? And then we're doing Cinema Paradiso.
And then we're doing Hugo.
Why do I feel like I'm in a Dr. Seuss book?
I know.
So, Ricardo, why don't you tell us about The Purple Rose of Cairo?
Okay. Written and directed by Woody Allen, The Purple Rose of Cairo follows Cecilia, Mia Farrow, an everyday person who lives a depressing life during the Great Depression in the 1930s. Set in New Jersey, she works as a part-time waitress who's clumsy, has an abusive husband she always goes back to because, well, what else is she going to do? But finds light and hope in the movies, and The Purple Rose of Cairo is the movie she loves right now. She sees it over and over again until the lines between reality and fantasy become blurred, and one of the characters in the film, Tom, a young archaeologist played by Jeff Daniels, walks off the screen literally into her life. As the public, Hollywood, and also actors in the film try and deal with the situation, Cecilia and Tom begin a fairy tale romance only seen in the movies, and Cecilia sparkles. But when word gets out, the ambitious actor Gil, who plays Tom in the movie, Jeff Daniels again, realizes his career is endangered. He tries desperately to get Tom back into the movie, then also falls for Cecilia, prompting her to choose between reality and fantasy. With a perfect mix of whimsy and melancholy, The Purple Rose of Cairo explores how cinema can really be an escape from the real world. What did you think, Greg?
I think that this is a charming film that stands up really well. And it's interesting how you just said that fantasy and reality begin to blur.
Absolutely.
But not just for her, for everyone. And one of the things I really loved this time around was that everyone is very matter-of-factly accepting the fact that it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The people inside the movie, the people in the cinema, the Hollywood studio execs and the lawyers
yes.
and so on, yeah. they're all focused on what this means, but there's no sense of, this is a bit unbelievable.
A bit odd.
Everybody
yeah.
is just going with it. And that makes it really charming.
It does, yeah.
When Woody Allen is at his best, yeah, he writes great lines. And you know, I jotted some of them down. At one stage, Cecilia says, "I just met a wonderful man. He's fictional, but you can't have everything." You know,
yes,
I laugh at that. Or the Tom character says, "Well, I never met my father. He died before the movie begins." You know, it's just all this great stuff about the fact that people are fictional and that's their limits.
Well, it's not really surprising with Woody Allen. I mean,
no.
screenplays, I mean, he's such a great writer of screenplays. His writing is very much his strong point. But escapism is really the central theme in The
yes.
Purple Rose of Cairo. Okay. I love the comic moments
yes.
you know, in the movie. You know, when Tom realises the real world is far more complicated than the movie world. All those scenes of the fake money he gives to the waiter in the restaurant. It's just hilarious. You know, when they kiss and he expects a fade out to happen.
Yes. And then when he's taken to a brothel.
Yes.
And he can't even remove his hat.
No.
I mean, they're funny. And this is classic Woody Allen. You know, there are
yeah.
funny little touches all the way through.
Mm.
When the movie breaks down, you know, in terms of its plot moving forward
mm-hmm.
because Tom escapes,
right.
it's the priest who gets out the cards that he carries around for them all to play poker. You
yes.
know, there's just all this stuff all the way through.
Mm. It's a sweet and sad film at the same time.
Have I ever told you the story about when I first saw this film?
No.
So I first saw this film, it had been out a year or so, I saw it at home on video.
Mm.
And probably with a few of these films tonight, I want to be careful about spoilers. But the end of the film completely caught me off guard.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the only time in my life I have yelled at the screen, you know, in my own home, but
yes.
yelled at the screen and was calling Woody Allen all kinds of names because he'd set me up for a particular, I thought, a particular kind of where the story was going to go
mm-hmm.
and then completely ripped that away. And I was just so shocked and disappointed because I was totally into this whole your romantic thing of this sad character
yes.
in a forgotten corner of the Depression who suddenly has all these good things coming to her. I was totally rooting for that. And then he just yanked it away.
He does.
So
but
it's just melancholy. It's a bit savage.
He does. But, you know, always the same, because you automatically want that really lovely ending.
You want that Hollywood ending.
You do want that Hollywood ending. But it's sad, because for a few moments there, when she feels her and Gil will be together and run off to Hollywood, she shows a real strength in those sequences, mm-hmm. which you know is there. You know, and through the film, she hasn't shown them. She's been sort of very sort of pushed down, and yep. you know, the husband, Danny Aiello, his character is really abusive. And
the
he's
only
just,
person who cares for her is her sister.
Really, that's the only person. And so, but when she feels like she's got something there with Gil and she's going to run off to Hollywood, jeepers, she shows a real strength. She stands up to her husband. She's going to leave. And then suddenly...
She tries to teach... she tries to treat Tom, the movie character, mm-hmm. decently.
And then it does. It gets ripped away at the end. But I think that is a... I think it's a good thing.
Why?
Because part of me thinks when at that ending... It made me wonder, when I watched it the second time, when I just rewatched it, did any of this happen?
Oh, you think it was all in her mind?
It really could have been. Really, when she was watching Fred Astaire, and Fred Astaire's on the cinema at the end, I really thought, wow, could Fred Astaire, she could make Fred Astaire come out. This is where her life is. The cinema is her escapism.
I don't buy that, because there are scenes that she has no knowledge of. You have the scenes of the Hollywood execs and the lawyers, originally in Hollywood, and then
she could think that
in the movie. And it's Woody Allen. I mean, one of the great things about Woody Allen is that he'll write very grounded kind of dramas, but he'll write wonderful flights of fancy, and he'll sometimes combine them. And my favourite Woody Allen films, you know, some of them are those real fantasy kind of things. So there's Alice. There's The Purple Rose of Cairo. There's the wonderful, some of the wonderful musical scenes in Everyone Says I Love You.
Mm.
You know, the wonderful recreation of the Gene Kelly dance,
yes.
Down by the Seine. And in all of those films, it's just accepted that this is real. You know, it's fantasy stuff, but it's you know, really happening in the context. And no, I don't buy that.
Yeah. No, look,
it's an interesting thought, but I don't buy it.
It's another way to look at it, really. Just the way it lingered on her. And the way it lingered on the cinema screen, and it lingered on her quite a bit. I mean, yes, it's quite sad because she's going back to her life.
Well, that's how I understood it.
Really,
that she had this very sad existence. Then suddenly everything starts to become really wonderful. She's spoilt for choice, and then she stands up to her husband or whoever else, as you say. And then it's taken away from her, and so she goes back to that fantasy world, and she just, you know, the film starts with her gazing at that movie poster.
That's right.
And it ends with her gazing at the screen.
Yeah.
And because that's the only place she can go to be happy.
It's her sanctuary.
Yeah, exactly. And her fantasy and her escape, as you said earlier. So I didn't think it was all in her head. It's just that there is only reality. There is no fantasy. Whether it's Tom coming at the screen or the dream of running away for Hollywood star, there's no escape. You have a reality. And this thing is something to let you feel better, but it's not something that will actually take you out of your situation.
Well, one thing I just like about that ending, because of our discussion here, is it is open to a lot of different interpretation.
And you dislike that?
No, I like that.
Oh, right,
I like that. No, I really like that. I think that leaves a lot open, and you can sort of take what you want to from that ending. Rather than just have and I think the ending's perfect. I don't think it needs to be the Hollywood ending. But apparently the executives of the studio really wanted the Hollywood ending.
Mm-hmm.
But Woody Allen said he wasn't going to do that.
And he's so established, he has the power, I would imagine, to do that.
Absolutely. Not many people do have that power to do that. And apparently this film is the perfect realisation of his original intent for the movie.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You know, a great thing about watching a Woody Allen film again is that there are always little details you can pick up on and appreciate that you don't necessarily realise the first time through, because you're so focused on, you know, the big jokes and where the story's going and what people are saying to each other. For example, I hadn't realised before that all the way through, Gil is saying he's hoping to get selected to play Charles Lindbergh in a film.
In a film,
and
yeah.
He's afraid of flying.
Jeff Daniels is really,
he is fantastic in
so
this.
Good in this. It's the best thing I've ever seen him in.
I've seen him in a lot of things, and I always enjoy his performance. But this, I think, was one of his first leads, if not the first. And he just works. He plays both the totally wide-eyed, innocent movie character and the Hollywood actor.
They're very different. Very different characters, and you believe them both.
And when they have the scenes, and you see this in a few movies where the same actor is playing two characters, having a conversation with themselves, it just flowed between the two versions of him.
It really did. And
if you didn't know it was the same actor.
Of course, and that was really well done. But there's one bit when he walks up to him and actually touches He actually holds...
But wasn't he from the back?
Don't think he was. I don't know how they did it. I thought it was a double. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. But they did it really well. I don't know, when I was watching it, they did it so well.
But one of the great things about Woody Allen, and I think it's a two-edged sword, he gets very good actors involved.
He does.
So you and I were talking earlier about the fact that when he goes to the brothel, one of the ladies of the night is Glenn Headley, before she's well-known. And that's another delight of going back to watch a film, is someone who's quite well-known but wasn't then. You suddenly go, oh, my God, that was Glenn Headley.
That's right.
But did you notice that, you know, the actors who were inside the movie, there were some really well-known established actors there.
There were.
So you had Van Johnson from the heyday of Hollywood. You had Milo O'Shea playing the priest. You had the Australian veteran actress Zoe Caldwell playing the Countess.
Oh, wow, that was her.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then Edward Herman, one of the male socialites. And the other one, I had to look up his name because I didn't know what it was. He's John Wood, but someone that you see in lots and lots of things. Yeah, the very British guy. Mm-hmm. Really great actors inside the movie, but also in the outside world. So you mentioned Danny Aiello. We mentioned Jeff Daniels being fantastic in this. Mia Farrow, back when they used to speak.
Mia Farrow is fantastic. Mm. She's wonderful in the film as well. Let's not talk about Jeff Daniels without talking about Mia Farrow movie. She really holds
the film. Well, she's the heart of the film.
She really is the heart of the film. I tend to like Woody Allen movies. But the ones with Woody Allen when he's not acting in them.
Or when he's got somebody else playing him, and this is where it's two-edged sword. Right,
exactly.
You know, there are a number of films where, and in one case it was a female actor, but often it's a male actor who is doing Woody Allen.
That's right.
So John Cusack in Bullets Over Broadway
comes
to mind.
Kenneth Branagh in one of them.
Whichever it was. And what was there was a female one recently. I think it might have been Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, right, I didn't know.
Whoever it was, I just remember thinking, oh, my God, they're doing Woody Allen as well.
That's right.
And I don't need someone to channel Woody to be the main Woody Allen character, because it's usually the main character.
Yeah.
And that's my one critique of how he works with actors, is when he does that and it's so heavy-handed. With very, very good actors like John Cusack and so on.
But he was wonderful in Bullets Over Broadway, though. That's probably my favourite
Woody
Allen.
He was, but he was channelling Woody.
All of them do.
I love Diane Wiest, which is going, don't speak.
Oh, it's wonderful. Perfect. You know? Yeah, that's wonderful.
I think that's been turned into a musical, actually.
Has
Broadway,
it?
I think, yeah.
Well, one of a really good film of Woody Allen, which was completely outside his style, is Match Point.
Which I haven't seen. That's one of the few I haven't seen.
It's a good thriller.
The other thing that's really clear in a lot of his films, and very clear in this one because it is so much about cinema, is just how much he loves the movies. So, you know, the recreation, even the feel of that black and white 1930s film, not just the film stock, but, you know, the sets that they're on, the nightclub and the apartment.
And the way he directs them too, because that is not a 1940s movie which they've just taken there. That is recreated, and he recreates it with all these different cinema techniques of, you know, these tracking shots and all. It just looks like a 1940s film.
It just has that feel.
It's got that great feel.
But even the scene where Gil and Cecilia are in the music shop and she's playing the ukulele and he sings a song.
Oh, I love that scene.
But that felt to me like something straight out of a 40s film. You know, when they go to the music shop and then they do a musical number, it was just like that.
And it sounded so good too, when the woman with the piano joins in.
And sometimes Woody Allen will stick a scene in from an old film that just feels like he's kind of sticking a scene in, he's making a point. There was one, it might have been Crimes and Misdemeanors, where the Woody Allen character goes to the cinema very depressed, then he sees a Marx Brothers scene and he kind of understands, I think, the meaning of life. It's kind of like, yeah, okay, fine. But in this one, it just totally works.
Everything works in it. And I think the ending is perfect, but I think everything sort of works in this. And even the lighting in this movie is very dark. It's very dark lighting.
Yes.
It's a very
oh, yes.
dark film, which reflects the depression.
Yeah, well, it's depressed, all round depressed.
Absolutely. But then you've got this light of cinema. That's what shines through it, is the love and life of cinema and what it brings.
Also, when talking about this film, and I think I'm right about this, is that it was quite influential. I don't remember films before this where people could move between the real world and the world behind the screen.
Well, it breaks the fourth wall, and that's what's so... It's great about it. Woody Allen does do it quite a lot in his movies. He did it in Annie Hall. He breaks the fourth wall.
Oh, okay.
Okay, which is basically an imaginary wall audience.
But after this, we've seen it in The Last Action Hero with Schwarzenegger.
Oh, of course.
We've seen it in Paddington.
Scorsese always does it.
Did he do it before or after Allen? Oh. Like, what I'm really asking is this Allen's idea?
No, it's not. Oh, okay. No. It's been done quite a few times. It gets done in theatre all the time. It's But it's challenging in a cinema sense when they do that.
I don't think of that as breaking the fourth wall. To me, breaking the fourth wall is a character talks to the audience.
That's right.
This is about that something living within a filmed world can actually come out into the real world.
Yeah, that is essentially breaking a fourth wall for those characters. I mean, he does do it. I mean, he's not talking directly to us, but he's still breaking the fourth wall.
So where does Scorsese do it?
Oh, he does it in Goodfellas.
I've seen very few Scorsese films.
He does it in The Wolf on Wall Street, where they're just talking to you.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when a character inside a film world comes out into the real world, even if it's inside the film itself.
And in The Purple Rose of Cairo, it's breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, okay. I want to have breaking the fifth wall. Yeah,
well, we can. You can.
I'm wondering, was Woody Allen the first one to break the fifth wall? I don't know. Well, so, okay, so out of 10, what do you reckon?
I am going to give it it's really hard, actually. It's a really hard one because I do love the film. I'm going to give it an 8.
It's an 8 for me too, actually. Yeah. It stands up well. It just works in its own right. It's a good film. It's not a great film, but it's a memorable film. And as I say, when I first saw it, I had that very emotional response. I felt tricked.
Yeah, an 8 from me too. And it's beautiful. It's such a lovely piece of cinema. So the second film we are going to discuss is Cinema Paradiso.
Okay, so in this film, Salvatore De Vita, played by Jacques Perrin, is a successful Italian filmmaker based in Rome. One night he receives a phone call from his mother to tell him that his childhood friend and mentor has died. Alfredo, Philippe Noiré, was a cinema projectionist in their Sicilian village in the years following World War II. Sometimes willingly, often not, Alfredo allowed the young boy into his world above the cinema, where Toto, the boy, fell deeper in love with the movies and learned the projectionist's craft. Much of the original 1988 movie consists of Salvatore's memories of his childhood as Toto, a startlingly engaging child played by 8 or 9-year-old Salvatore Cazzio. And remind me never to do Italian films with you again, Riccardo. These memories are followed by scenes from Toto's late teen years. The last part of the film shows what happens when the adult Salvatore goes home for the funeral and what he receives as his final gift from Alfredo's widow. There's at least 3 versions of this film, and the one you've probably seen is the 2-hour one that won the 1990 Oscar for Best Foreign Film. And it's treasured by many people for its loving yet clear-eyed depiction of an adult-child friendship and its homage to the world of film across the 20th century. But there's also a 3-hour director's cut version that shows much more of what happens to the teenager and the adult. And this is the version that Riccardo and I have been watching. So, Riccardo, what did you think?
I remember seeing this movie a long time ago, and it really is a celebration of film. I loved it. I loved the film when I saw it the first time. I had never seen the director's cut, and so there is an hour, pretty much, added to it. But you know what? I didn't feel that go by. I was in this movie from the very first frame. And, you know, I'll tell you something. It must be something with Italian movies or whatnot with me, but I just tend to get very emotional about that time of
really
history.
You surprised me.
It's my history. It's my family's history in Italy at that time. And I can see my family in some of the characters. So obviously it has such a connection with me. And the father-son, again, relationships are always something which I really love in movies, and this sort of, you know, uncle, you know, friend and a father figure to the little Toto is wonderful and beautiful, and it's such a gorgeous relationship which just had me emotionally.
Well, there are echoes in this film and in your emotional response to this film with the bicycle thief.
Yeah, there is.
Very much. We spoke when we talked about that in one of our very early podcasts. We spoke about how about your family history and about how it just resonates with you and so on.
It does. I loved all of the scenes with him becoming learning to be a projectionist and their relationship between that.
I'm angry about this film. And I'm a little bit angry with you, actually.
Why?
Because we were talking about, okay, which version should we watch? And you were saying, oh, look, let's watch the director's version. I wish I'd never seen it.
Why?
And well, I'm going to read you. I got a text from my wife today after we watched the film only last night, and she perfectly encapsulates how I feel. This is what she said. I really, really wish I could unwatch the film last night. What was once a beautiful story about friendship and love was turned into one about destructive and dysfunctional relationship. I feel so robbed of a beautiful memory.
And no!
Absolutely.
Not at all.
No, this is exactly how I feel about this film. I wish I'd never seen it.
No! There's a lot of story which has been added, okay, to this version. Obviously, there's an hour which has been added to the movie, and there is a lot of story with the grown-up Toto, okay, when he comes back to the to his town, Giancarlo. Now, in the original version, he doesn't really do much. And I don't know if you've seen the movie, he gets a cinema can at the end and watches, I'm not going to tell you what it is just in case you haven't seen it, but watches a film which was left by Alfredo, which was his mentor, and it's a beautiful sequence. Now, that's pretty much all that there is. But in the director's cut, there's so much more story, and I think now I can't rewatch the original because of this. I think every part which was added...
But that's actually my
problem.
In terms
of the town, I think the characters, you're seeing more of the characters in terms of the cinema-loving town. And so, therefore, when at the end, when he comes back and there's the cinema paradiso there and people are looking upon it, I know those characters. I've seen more of them. I think the director's cut is perfect.
That's not my problem. I agree with everything you said, but what my problem is what you haven't said. So you get a lot more story about the love affair in his teen years.
Absolutely.
And when you see the three-hour version, after I watched the three-hour version, I went back and skimmed through the two-hour version to kind of see where were these differences. And you realise that, in fact, big chunks of the teen story and the adult story not only have been cut, but other scenes have been cut in a way where they've actually been quite savaged.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm with you there in the sense that you find out so much more about him as a teenager and the great love of his life. You find out so much more about what happened when he goes back to town and when he goes to try and re-establish that relationship that ended in a way he didn't understand, and which we find out in this three-hour version what happens.
Absolutely, which is beautiful.
But yes, except I have one big problem with it, and my wife had the same problem, another problem. The one she had on her own was she really disliked the whole story of how he tried to re-establish contact with the great love of his life. And she found that quite stalkerish. She really didn't like that story at all. I kind of got that, but she really didn't. But the one bit that we both really hated and I wish I had never, ever, ever seen was when you eventually find out why that relationship ended. There's an act by someone in the film that does that. That does two things. It totally changes my understanding of a core relationship in the film. The thing that was actually most beautiful about the two-hour version, to me, becomes really horrible in some ways. And the second thing about it is I think it totally changes the meaning of that final sequence. So in the two-hour version of the film, it's a thing of beauty, and I cried when I saw it. I was, I'm a real softie, but I was... tears pouring down my face.
I still cried at this.
And I know a lot of people do. And I've seen at least that end scene again since I first saw it when it came out. And it's a really beautiful thing. And to me, I don't know if I could ever have, and maybe still can't, really quite articulate what I thought that sequence was really saying. But to me, it was a gift of pure love from the older mentor to his protege who's gone on and just accomplished all these amazing things that he wanted him to accomplish. Here's this thing that you could never have before. I'm now giving it to you. It celebrates love. It celebrates the movies.
Yes.
In the three-hour version, I'm left really wondering if the message of that last sequence was you can't be devoted to film and have love in real life. So here's a celebration of the love that you can't have in film, but not in real life. And I think it becomes a very different message.
It wasn't about... No, it was about him fulfilling his dreams in that town. He had to move away.
No, I got that. And I got that in both versions.
Yeah, well,
but because of this one act that happens that you only find out in the three-hour version...
We're not going to say this out.
No, we don't. I really don't want to spoil this film for people who have had the treasured memory that I had until 24 hours ago.
Look, I do understand what you're saying as well. But I saw it in a little bit of a different way.
If you hadn't had that one thing, everything else is added. I totally agree with you. You get a much richer sense of the communal life. You get a much richer sense of how this cinema is the place where life happens. You have babies being breastfed. You have people having sex.
Yes.
Someone losing their virginity. Someone dying. People meeting who become lifelong partners, and so on and so you know, you have all that. You have all the things going around the town that move through that, you know, religion and even a bit of the politics.
The priest cutting out the kisses.
Yeah. So all those things about the small village life and how it's very much interwoven with what happens in the cinema and vice versa. So you find out more about that. It's much richer. You find out a lot more about the teenage Salvatore.
Yeah, and the older.
And the love.
It's equal to either one. I mean, I
would much prefer the three-hour version if you didn't have that one thing in that I really hate the fact it was there.
It didn't bother me as much as it bothered you. It really didn't.
Well, and if anyone wants to know a bit more about this, because we are being careful, go and look at some of the reviews on IMDb, and you'll find a number of people saying exactly the same thing, that they wish they'd never seen the three-hour version. It took something which was a really beautiful, cherished memory, the experience of seeing the two-hour version of the film, and changing in a way that, you know, what is seen cannot be unseen. And I really wish wholeheartedly that I had never seen this. I came today prepared for the first time not to rate a film. I will rate it, but I really came thinking, I can't rate this because there are these two really different versions of the film, and I can't recapture now what I really... I thought this would be a very simple conversation. We both loved the film.
So did I. So did I. And I'm quite surprised you're saying that. I mean,
there are beautiful things in this film. And again, things that I didn't pick up on the first time. So when Salvatore comes home for the funeral and he arrives at his mother's house and she gets up to go to the door, and the camera, in both versions, the camera is very deliberately focuses on a chair where she drops her knitting needle and her knitting catches
beautifully
on her.
Look,
and it's a visual metaphor. You know, you just know that what it's saying is now what has been done is starting to unravel.
It's starting to unravel. Look, this is beautifully directed by Giuseppe Tornatore.
Beautiful cinematography.
He's a wonderful director.
Great performances. I've always had a big soft spot for Philippe Noiret because he was in the first foreign language film I ever saw.
Oh, wow.
The L'Orlogere de Saint-Paul. That I saw at school.
Even from the opening when the older Toto is in Rome and he looks out the window and sees chimes. You see some chimes in the distance.
Which then become the acoustic link back to his memories of the
altar. It does. And you see the shadow over his face. It's so beautifully shot, this film.
And the transition from young Toto to teenage, which is that Alfredo becomes blind.
Yes.
And he's feeling the face of young Toto and then the camera moves to him, and then he's still feeling the face, but now it's the teenager.
Now it's the teenager. It's
there are different ways that directors show a character is now played by another actor.
That's right.
And this is a very beautiful way he's done it.
It's very well done. But the whole
you
film...
You cut out that one thing, and I'm totally with you. It's that one thing I really wish that he hadn't done. It's interesting. I then went on to watch some of the extras on the DVD. You know, it was the 25th anniversary edition where they talked to Donatore, they talked to Noiret, they talked to the grown-up Toto actor...
Yes.
And somebody else I've forgotten. And there was a strong sense from what Noiret said and from what Tornatore said that he wasn't the easiest person to get along with in the filming of this movie. And I kind of wonder if he is maybe not as emotionally intelligent as the film suggests that he is, because I think it was a big mistake, a really big mistake, to take something that he became very famous for because people treasured it, won the Oscar, really is one of those films that has lodged in people's hearts, and then done something which I think corrupts it.
I really don't think it corrupts it.
This is one of these things you and I are going to disagree with, but I just feel so strongly about this. I really wish I hadn't seen it.
I'm actually really surprised you're feeling this strongly about it.
I
really do, because it didn't take the emotion away from me from the ending. It didn't do anything like that. But I think the film, like, getting back to just the way it seamlessly ties in, you know, from the young Toto to the teenager to the old. Well, I think it's also got a seamless progression in terms of cinema going over time, you know, and showing the town over time. It goes from silent films to talkies to black and white to colour, cinema to the evolution of television.
Yes.
And it does it so well. And when you're looking at the young Toto and you're seeing this, the beautiful Italian town there and village and from the early days, and then when you see it, like, at the end now, you sort of wish for the old days.
Oh yes,
because it just looks like there's advertising on the street walls.
It feels more hemmed in.
Yes, and also
when it's
like
got that beautiful open square.
Yes, which is completely overrun with cars and everything now. And I, you know, the town where my family are from in Canzano, Italy, I love it that it's in the mountains, it's in the Abruzzo mountains. And when you go there, there's only 250 people live there. It is still very, very bare and not a lot of people live there. And it's beautiful when you walk around those sorts of streets like that. It hasn't been touched that way or tainted.
And we talked about Purple Rose of Cairo, about, you know, in that film, that cinema is about escape.
Yes.
This is quite different. This is where cinema is about magic. The scene where the film moves along the wall and then goes out into the square.
That is magic. That's a beautiful sequence. I mean, I was crying. I was crying from 20 minutes in this movie. I don't know what it was doing for me, but the score's beautiful as well. I mean, it just had me.
So to pick up my thesis again, cinema is magic.
Yes.
Cinema is very much part of, you know, the weaving of the tapestry of the village. It's at the heart.
Yes.
In some ways, it's the alternative to the church. Mm-hmm. And it's something where, as I say, everything happens, you know, sleep, love, babies, mm-hmm. even someone dying. It's very much at the heart of that communal life.
Yeah.
And he really shows that beautifully. The other thing I think which comes through in the three-hour version, because I'm going to harp on this, you know, is that belonging to the world of film can be an obsession. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember this being the two-hour version, but there was a moment in the one that I watched yesterday where Alfredo tells Salvatore, I think it might be the teenage Salvatore, that he was showing Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, which we reviewed in an earlier podcast, and his first wife had died, mm-hmm. and no one told him until he'd finished because they wanted to see the film.
Right.
And the same happens to Toto, that he becomes obsessed with film, even down to learning the taste of it, which I thought was a lovely part.
Oh, that
of
was
it,
great.
Which the I don't remember from the first time around.
The gelatin, yeah.
Yes, that he learns the taste for film.
That's right.
On his journey to becoming a filmmaker.
Yes.
He then has a life where, as his mother says to him in both versions of the film, I speak to these women who answer your phone, and in none of their voices do I hear that they love you. So there are women who are kind of his companions for a part of his life, but no one really that is his love, and the love becomes the film.
I think in both versions that it has quite a few different meanings there. In the original version, it's all about the cinema and what filmmaking and your obsession with film.
Yes.
But in the
three-hour
version, it's not just the film that it's been, it's also referring to a love of his.
And not only his, but about the mother's life. I say, if it's not for this one thing in the three-hour version, I think it is a much richer, stronger, better film. Mm. And because you learn so much more about this thing, which really kind of ends abruptly in the first one, which is about the great love of his life and what happens there.
Yeah.
So everything except that one thing, I'm totally with you. There's so much more in it. It's so much more rooted in the life of the town. You get a stronger sense of, you know, what he's like at different stages of his life. As the child, he's just, you know, bubbling.
What a great performance.
A bit of an operator. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
who'd never acted before.
No, he's wonderful.
He was found in one of the local villages.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was watching A Life is Beautiful, which is the Roberto Benigni film.
Which I didn't
film.
Like, yeah.
So I loved that movie quite a lot. There was moments in Cinema Paradiso, which I think Life is Beautiful took out of that movie, the winks and whatnot between that father, that relationship there. But I love.
Although it's a different relationship because Alfredo gets tired of the boy sometimes and, you know, tells him to get out.
He's not his father. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's actually probably a surrogate grandfather rather than father even. But so you've got the young boy who is very full of life and mischief and
loves film.
Does what he wants to do.
That's right.
You have the teenager who's kind of finding his way in the world, discovers great love, ends up having to join the army for a period of time and kind of learning not everything goes his way. And then you have the older man who's melancholy, there's a bittersweet element to his life, which you don't see in the two-hour version. Mm. I mean, poor Jacques Perrin, who plays the adult Salvatore, has almost nothing to do in the two-hour version.
He doesn't. This is what I loved about the three-hour version.
And if you want everything except this one thing. And I just, I wish I could unwatch the film. I really do.
That's really interesting, that one moment.
Yeah.
There were so many parts to the three-hour version,
but
which was
it's
so
something
good.
Which sabotages the very heart of
no,
the film.
No, it doesn't.
It does.
It really
it
doesn't.
Does.
But it really doesn't, audience. I wouldn't be taken aback by what Greg's saying, because I think it is fine. I mean, you can make your own mind up, really, but I don't think it's as big a deal.
See, I think this is probably, at the heart of filmmaker, film watcher.
Mm.
Because you're talking about as both. I think you're talking about it in terms of your emotional response as a watcher of the film, the links to your own, you know, heritage and interests and father-son stories and so on. And you're also talking about it in terms of, I think, the craft of the film.
Yeah.
And I respect the craft of the film, but I think it, that one thing was such a mistake.
Well, it was a choice, really. It was a bad choice. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that the film didn't do well in originally, I think, a 2.5-hour version.
No.
And Tornatore didn't want to change it, and he was really pushed by the producer, Franco Cristaldi, who seems to have been a real shaper of how this film developed in its early versions and its own transitions. And he's talked about quite a bit, particularly by Donatore in these 25th anniversary interviews. And he talks about the fact that there were scenes that he didn't think the producers would let him film, so he's kind of almost filming them almost on the quiet, because this guy, this Franco producer guy, is someone who was very much at the heart of the shared vision. They talked about who they would cast, and they tried to get Marcello Mastroianni at first, and then Franco Cristaldi says to Donatore, well, we want to get the international reach, so if it was an Italian actor, who would you want? And he says, well, I'd like Noiré, and they're going to get Noiré. So he was very much at the heart of it. And I'd be curious to know if he's still alive, and if he was alive when the director's cut was released, because I think he's the one who saw what would make it really successful.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, when you see the three-hour version, you realise that some of that was quite savage, but it made it a more satisfying whole in a very sentimental way.
Well, you know what? I actually think you should watch the original first and then the director's cut. Okay, hang on, hear me out here.
I haven't said a word.
Hang on a minute. Hear me.
My face is speaking, but my lips are silent.
Hang on. Because, yes, you do get that sense of the original, which makes it so successful. You know, it really is quite a quick story. Now, if you were to watch the director's cut from the beginning, I think it would be quite long for you. I think between the younger Toto and going to the teenage Salvatore Toto, it sort of stops. You get this great relationship between Alfredo and Toto, and then it hits the teenage years, and then suddenly the sort of... It stops. The film sort of halts a bit and goes right into the town and their love for film, which takes you a bit out of the story. And then it brings you back
but
again.
But I don't mind that.
No, really. But I think for somebody to watch that for the first time, it might actually draw them out again. And there are some scenes within the showing the older Salvatore, you know, with his long-lost love at the very end in a car sequence, which is really quite long. It's really long. Now, I didn't mind that, but I could just tell that this is quite long, and I think they are indulging themselves here a little bit.
And my advice is that if you have any kind of treasuring or sentimental attachment to the two-hour version, don't see the director's cut. And if you do, well, on your own cognizance, because I think that love is endangered.
And there's one thing I want to talk about, just in terms of the job of a projectionist. I think there's a bit of a mystique. I've always found a bit of a mystery with these people who you're watching a movie but there's this sort of lone person in the back making it all happen. Tarantino was very big on The Hateful Eight, which he shot in 70mm. So apparently he visited a lot of theatres when he went doing his world tour and did surprise visits to the cinemas they were showing at, to meet the projectionist and how they were going to project it. You know, you could spend all your money and so much money on a film to make it look good, but if your projectionist stuffs it up or puts it a little bit out of focus or something, or has it a little bit off frame, you know, your movie's not great.
Do you know who the projectionist was for that final sequence?
Who was that?
That was Tornatore.
Was it really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
And when they filmed Jacques Perrin's response to that, they did two takes. He knew vaguely what was happening in the script, but they didn't tell him. They certainly didn't show him what was there. And they filmed it twice, and they really used the takes from the first filming of his genuine response to the film. And it was very much about Donatore showing the film as a projectionist to his lead character.
Wow. Okay, we're going to have to rate this.
Yes.
I'd rate the original a 10. I think it is very complete. And when I first saw it as well, I think it's a very complete film and you'll love it. It is a classic of cinema and such a joyous ode to cinema.
If you haven't seen it, it's so worth seeing.
It's wonderful. But in terms of the director's cut, I'm going to give it a 9. The reason being is I think it does indulge itself a little bit too much. I don't have that problem you had, but I do think that it does overstay its welcome a little bit. Okay, so therefore I'm just going to drop back to a 9. It's still a classic, but, you know.
Well, I'm going to surprise you. I rate them both as a 10.
Okay.
I hate the second one. I wish I'd never seen it. But I absolutely respect the craft. And I understand what you're saying about everything else that becomes, you know, richer and broader in that second film. I never want to see it again.
Yes.
But I think it's a 10. But I also think the original one is a 10 because it really, I think it much more captures you up in the whole sparkle of the relationship between the boy and the projectionist.
Yes.
And that becomes the heart of the film because the other two parts of his life are so much more truncated. I think it's a 10 in its own right because it just does, for so many people, including myself and you, engender such a deep emotional response and a treasuring of that film. And so I think in that respect, it's a masterpiece as well. I think they're masterpieces a different way, which is a funny thing to say about the same film, but it's not the same film. You may have noticed that the three films that we're talking about today are being discussed in chronological order. So we had Purple Rose of Cairo in 1985, we had Cinema Paradiso in 1988, and now, Ricardo, tell us about Hugo from 2011.
The great director Martin Scorsese loves film and spends a lot of time trying to educate people on the history of film with his History of American Cinema documentaries and also the Italian film documentary My Voyage to Italy. He also spends a lot of time trying to restore old film prints so they're not lost forever. So he obviously loves film, but usually directs dramatic movies with plots much darker than this 2011 family-friendly film, Hugo, which tells the story of an orphan boy, Hugo Cabré, Asher Butterfield, who has been secretly living within the clocks and walls of a Paris train station, keeping the time. He also spends time finding parts to fix a broken automaton that his father, Jude Law, a clockmaker, spent time on trying to fix before he died by a fire. Hugo wholly believes this automaton contains a message from his father. All he needs now is a heart-shaped key to unlock it. Having stolen parts from an old toy shop, he gets caught by a cold, sad, reserved man who runs the toy shop, George, Ben Kingsley, who takes Hugo's father's notebook and threatens to destroy it. Through this, he sparks a relationship with the old man's goddaughter, Isabel, Chloe Grace Moretz, and they both get caught up in a magical, mysterious adventure, revealing the secrets behind the automaton and discovering that the old man of the toy shop was indeed the great pioneer filmmaker, Georges Méliès. And here is where Scorsese really shows his passion for the medium, giving us a glimpse into the history of film and how it started through the eyes of Georges Méliès, recreating set pieces only read in film history books. This film was Scorsese's first film shot in 3D, and he really makes it work, together with his brilliant and my favourite cinematographer, Robert Richardson. The film also stars Sacha Baron Cohen, Ray Winston, Emily Mortimer, and the late Christopher Lee and Richard Griffiths. And the film is also based on the best-selling book by Brian Selznick called The Invention of Hugo Cabré. So what do you think of this film, Greg?
You haven't mentioned Francis de la Tour, who plays the cafe owner, who I always love as well.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that this actually is a children's film. I suspect it's a child story for adults. So when I was sitting down to watch these films for today's podcast...
Well, family-friendly.
Yeah, but neither of my sons wanted to watch it again. It was really interesting. They'd seen it, and my younger son will watch films again and again and again, you know, Disney, Scooby-Doo, and, you know, all these other things that are just on his perpetual rotation list. No interest at all. You know, do I have to watch Hugo? You know, that caught me off guard a bit. And the story, you're right about everything else. And it's interesting how all three of these directors that we're talking about today, you know, they're doing these films which are an ode to cinema, you know, a love letter to cinema.
That's right.
And they all obviously deeply love film. You know, Tornatore was a projectionist. Mm-hmm. That little trick where he shines the film out into the square, he learnt by being a projectionist. You know, right. He had a deep love and respect for that craft. Woody Allen, we know that's true. And we know about Scorsese, as well as being the film director that he is,
yes,
is also an absolute advocate for film preservation.
That's right.
And the history of film.
Yes.
And again, that just shines in this film.
It really does.
But I'm not sure it's a kid's film. It's a wonderful concoction. It looks terrific. And when I saw it at the movies, I saw it in 3D. Rewatching it this week, I saw it on a TV. And that is a different experience. Just well, I don't know if it's a kid's film.
Well, the thing is...
It's about kids.
My son has a different... I can watch this. I've watched this many times with my son. He gets this sort of love of old movies and whatnot. He likes old things. I brought him up on Chaplin. I brought him up on watching these movies. So when I first saw it, I saw it on IMAX 3D. because I thought, you know, I'm not a massive fan of the 3D medium.
No, nor I, with some rare exceptions, including this.
Absolutely, but I thought, well, there's only two 3D films I really enjoyed, and that was James Cameron's Avatar.
Yeah.
In terms of the 3D element of it, if anybody's going to do it well, it's going to be James Cameron because he's so up with wanting to make those sorts of bits work. So if you're going to see a 3D movie, see a James Cameron 3D because he's going to always do the best version of 3D you can find technologically. Whereas Hugo, it's Scorsese's first use of the medium. Apparently he's always loved the medium. So he's always going to not just do cheap 3D thrills in it. He's going to try and push it to a good level of 3D. And his cinematographer, like I said, Robert Richardson, is amazing. And so them working together, I thought, I have to see this in 3D. And it worked. I really loved it in 3D.
I also have two films where I think 3D really worked. Hugo is certainly one of them. The scene where the box of drawings falls out of the wardrobe.
Yes.
And they all swirl around the room.
That is an amazing sequence.
Which didn't look that great in 2D. It looked a little bit artificial. But in 3D, at the time, I remember being entranced by
that. It's in front of you. Yeah.
And the other one, I didn't have... I saw Avatar 3D. I liked the way that the subtitles were part of the 3D experience, yes, when the blue creature spoke. But it wasn't... I didn't love it in the way you did. The one for me that I loved was Tangled.
I never saw that in 3D.
The Disney version of Rapunzel. There's a scene where she's... The whole thing's about her quest to get back to the castle where she was kidnapped as a baby. And the male character, you know, the rogue, I think he's called Flynn, is taking her home. And every year on the anniversary of her birthday or disappearance, the townspeople light those kind of paper lanterns like you see in Japan,
yeah,
that go up into the sky. And the two main characters are crossing the lake towards the castle on a boat, and they're surrounded by these paper lanterns. And it was just beautiful.
But
and,
getting back to Hugo,
yeah,
in terms of being a family film, I think there's been I've heard a criticism, and I sort of agree to disagree, where I think the child in it and the kids, the children in it, actually talk like adults.
Or Enid Blyton characters almost, the girl, you know.
See, I think Ben Kingsley was fantastic. I think all the clockwork stuff.
Yes.
The clockwork
stuff. The drawings.
Stuff, yeah, the drawings, the inside the clock in the beginning. I thought that... All that is very family friendly. I think
I think that's it. I don't think it's a family film. I think it's a family friendly film that the adults can go and see and love. And the more that you love film or film preservation and history, the more I think you'll get out of it.
And it does
something
veer
not
away
quite there as a family children film.
Well, it veers away, and this is another criticism which I disagree with because I love where the film does go in terms of its film history. But it does sort of go away from the boy's story quite a bit at one section and becomes a film about Georges Méliès.
Yes.
Okay. So and then it sort of comes back to the boy again.
I didn't mind that because they're both interesting stories.
That's right.
And because the Méliès story is essentially true.
It is.
He went broke. He ended up running a toy shop at
the
station.
He did. So, and all of that. I mean, look, when I was younger, I think I was about 10 or 12, I got given a cinema history book, and that was my book. I'd read that every night. So I'd seen The First Kiss on screen. I'd look at pictures of Intolerance, D.W. Griffith's Intolerance, Birth of a Nation. I read about the Lumiere brothers and the scene where the trains coming into the cinema, trains coming into the station, and everybody
ducking.
I'd read so much about film history. So when it got recreated so well by Scorsese in this, I was really emotional about it because I just went, wow, it's all being recreated and just beautifully.
So you're probably not the typical audience member for this film.
I'm not. I'm completely not.
But I certainly recognise parts of it. I knew about the scene where the train goes through the wall of the station.
Yeah.
I recognised that scene of the two men dancing, which was one of the very early pieces of film. The First Kiss was there too, wasn't it?
It was.
So I recognised those. I recognised...
I mean, the moon
image. Yeah, I've said the Melius scenes of the moon being hit in the eye by the rocket, of the underwater kingdom, those scenes we saw in that history. I recognised all those, and although I wouldn't understand them or recognise them as deeply as I think you do, they still create that same buzz in me. But we're not necessarily the typical audience for this, and yet I think this is a loved film. The thing I noticed watching it this time around in 2D on my average-sized TV was how beautifully textured the whole film was.
It really is.
So even the wardrobe And the floorboards, I think in, what's the boy's name? Oh, Hugo, obviously. Dumb question. In Hugo's little hideaway inside the walls of the station.
Yes.
The cogs, the floorboards, everything was so beautifully detailed. And I imagine that's in part because one viewing experience was IMAX, big screen 3D, so it had to look right. But even on my little 2D, on my average size 2D screen, it just looked sumptuous.
Well, you know, it opens beautifully. It opens really beautiful on clockwork, which turns into time-lapse Paris. And then the camera follows through and goes into the station. And right, it just follows completely. It's a continuous shot through the station. And in 3D, it was amazing as well, seeing that.
Yeah.
To a close-up of Hugo's
eyes. Peering through the clock.
Peering through the clock. It's such a wonderful sequence, that, really, because there's not a lot of dialogue at all, and it introduces the characters of the station, which you get to know.
Did you know the book is approximately half text, half pictures?
Yeah, I did. I've read some of the book.
Which I think explains why the film is so, well, filmic, so pictorial.
It is.
Even down to the scene of him peering out to a number in the clock, which you actually see a few times in the film, and is certainly part of the book.
But I really feel sorry for Hugo. I mean, I really believe it's a great performance by Asher Butterfield in that movie, because I really felt for him. And the scenes with Jude Law and him together, I mean, he really does stand up. He's just a boy who becomes an orphan.
And Jude Law does very well in this film too. Yeah, it's a small part.
It is a small part.
And I didn't have my usual, you know, Disney response of, oh dear, they've killed off both parents.
No.
in the context of this, that made sense.
Yes, it does. It does.
Because it's not just that the death of the parents is to send him on a quest. Mm. It actually explains why he's so alone, in the same way that Méliès is as the old man. They're both quite alone and have to reconnect. You know, they are broken. They have cogs missing. They need to mesh to work, and it's a very clear message in the film.
Yeah, there's one section of the film when he breaks down, when the automaton doesn't work.
Yes.
And he breaks down in front of Isabel. I think he does really well in that scene. It means so much to him. And to see him break down that way when it doesn't work, suddenly you get all that frustration built up and you see what he's been through.
And what did you make of the dream sequence where he turns into the automaton?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it because it's a dream within a dream within a dream. And I think that's really good. Really well handled as well.
I also love the other film references. So when he's hanging off the clock, we've already seen them watch Harold Lloyd's Safety Last.
Yes, yes.
And
which is so classic.
And then they recreate it. I also wondered if the scenes looking down the tower inside the station were meant to reference Vertigo. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but this time around that kind of struck me, that looking down the windy staircase around the outside. The thing I also became much more aware of this time around was the artificiality of the visual presentation. And it was interesting to watch the scene from Safety Last, the Harold Lloyd film.
Yes.
And I've seen how that was actually filmed and how it created what was actually quite an artificial sense of danger when he was just, you know, 3 feet above a mattress and some pillows. But it looks like he's hanging off the edge of a skyscraper.
It really does. Yeah.
And then to map that onto the Hugo film, where so much of that is fake. You know, it's green screens and CGI. Even that sequence you loved. I mean, I was quite aware this time around of how that was artificially constructed.
Yes.
Until they got into the real set.
Yes.
And even that sumptuous detail and what I think was a graveyard outside the Méliès home with the big hooded statues there.
Yeah.
Which is quite, you know, dramatic.
It is dramatic.
In a Victor Hugo, Phantom of the Opera kind of way.
Yes, it is.
So it was really quite an artificial world, but I actually liked that.
Mm.
But I wasn't so aware of that the first time around.
But in talking about those two sections of the film, between Hugo's story to Georges Méliès's story, I think that can be a criticism, but I think it does at the very end mesh together really well.
I thought it did.
Because the automaton got fixed, and then as Georges Méliès says at the end, he took a broken man and he fixed him, which is a beautiful moment in the movie.
Yes, I got weepy in that final part in the theatre where they show his retrospective.
Yes, yeah.
And you would have surely noticed Martin Scorsese's cameo in those flashback scenes.
Where he's
the photographer.
He is.
So we've got notorious projectionists. Mm-hmm. We've now got Scorsese as a photographer. I don't think Woody Allen actually popped up in Pepper as a Pyro.
But I'm amazed at what Georges Méliès could do with he had, special effects-wise. At that time.
Oh, yes, and one of the great things about this film is that it restores him to a central point in film history.
Yeah.
Particularly for a non-French audience.
Yeah.
Who would have probably no idea about his history.
Amazing. The amazing scenes when he, you know, he's at the musical notes, when he's pulls off his head and it becomes a note and he moves.
Oh, yes, yes. It
becomes a note again. Oh, some great moments there for him. And so I think it's such a celebration of him, but also to silent film and the beginnings of what we see today. To show D.W. Griffith in there was one of the, was fantastic, because D.W. Griffith is quite renowned as called the father of film. You know, I think he made about 400 films. And he was quite an amazing filmmaker, made a very controversial film in 1914 called Birth of a Nation, and about the Ku Klux Klan, and portrayed them as heroes instead of villains. But then came out after he was getting quite, you know, it was quite a controversial film back then. He made the movie Intolerance 2 years later on the back of saying he wasn't a racist. So he made which was quite ambitious. And if you ever see Intolerance, it's worth a look. It's 3 hours. It's a silent movie, but jeepers. Really, the set pieces in that film, some of the biggest set pieces in history. So to mention that and pay homage to those, I mean, he invented the close up. I think D.W. Griffith, which is the, you know, you couldn't. I think the lenses could do that much of a close up. So it's focusing on a hand, you know, close up.
But I'm going to drag you back to Hugo and Méliès.
Yes, go for it.
In fact, I want to come back to our theme, which is about, you know, in each of these films, which are love letters to cinema,
yeah,
what are they saying about movies and about the cinema-going experience? Mm. And again, we hear in this film that, and I think I've said to you before, this is the way I like to define the cinema experience, is it's communal dreaming.
Yeah.
And so at that retrospective, Méliès says to the audience, you know, come and dream with me. Mm. But the other thing I picked up in my viewing of Hugo was that what makes movies magic and special is also the context in which you see them, who you see them with. Again, we have escapism. So his father used to take him to the movies after his mother died because it would distract them. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, he says, you know, I love the movies. Father always took me for my birthday. Yes. So movies become... And I know this myself, that I remember movies, particularly movies that I really loved, often in terms of who I saw it with.
Yeah.
So even something like Poltergeist 2, I thought was actually a really terrific, you know, film for the genre.
It's actually not a bad thing.
I know exactly who I saw it with. When we talked about Scrooge for our Christmas episode, again, I know exactly who I saw it with. When I saw that, it's part of my memory of what makes that special, that I shared it with my sister or whoever it might be.
I'm finding it less so now. I'm thinking the multiplexes I think you really have to go...
Or just watching it at home.
Watching it at home. There's so much available to go and see a movie that I feel like an event for me is to someone go to an older cinema. It feels nostalgic. I mean, there's a beautiful old 1920s cinema in Narooma, New South Wales, and I'll never forget that cinema because it's still got the old piano from when they used to show movies back in the old days. And when you sit in there, you feel like you're a part of film history, you know.
There's one here in Melbourne, or certainly used to be, where the organ still revolved up out of the stage.
Oh, where is that?
Oh, Coburg, maybe?
Oh, wow.
Here in Melbourne?
I mean, the Sun Theatre's always great in Melbourne, yep, as well. And, you know, I feel like I'm going to the movies there.
But I also like to go into movies where there's a lot of people. I don't want to be packed in with, you know, a huge crowd, but that's often why I try to go and see a movie at the cinemas if I'm going to go. Early on, while there's still people want to see it, because particularly something like a thrill movie or a sentimental movie or a comedy, it just works so much better when you're in that group.
It does.
It is that, you know, shared experience, communal dreaming.
Well, it's actually quite amazing because in the Astor Theatre in Melbourne, people applaud at the end of the movie.
Yeah, for the older ones, yes, that's true.
It's really interesting because I can't.
So it's like theatre rather than cinema.
It is, but people, there's an appreciation in that audience. When you're sitting in that cinema, which is all Art Deco, 1920s, but they were clapping at the end of the film, and you never see that in a multiplex.
No, funnily enough, you don't.
But there must be a real feeling, a sense of film, you know, a sense of a love for what you're watching and an appreciation for the art form itself when you're sitting in a cinema like that or in an environment like that.
I also just want to go back to who's in this film. So we talked about some of the greats, you know, Christopher Lee, one of his last films.
I think this actually is
Richard Griffith's last film.
Yeah, and it looked like it a little bit.
Actually for both of them.
Yes.
But there's also an actor who's up and coming who I've learned to watch out for now that I really enjoy watching, and it's the guy who played René Tabard, the film historian.
Yeah.
Whose name is Michael, I think I've got this right, Michael Stuhlbarg, I guess is how you say it. I first noticed him in Men in Black 3.
Oh, wow.
Have you seen that?
Yes, I have, yeah.
He was the alien who was slightly out of time with everybody else. It was the kind of part that Once Upon a Time Robin Williams might have played.
Right.
And I just remember watching him thinking, who is this guy? He is just doing this so well. He's so believable in this quite strange part. And he's this guy who's a bit of a chameleon. He pops up in these different things. He played Tavar.
He's really good in this. And I love that sequence when they're looking at the film history. It sort of flows on, and it's all part of the mystery of what this automaton is and who George Melies is. And I love that sequence when they're in the library and
suddenly he's there. And they're going, the guy in the book, that's you.
That's right. That's right. And she discovers, and Isabel discovers, that her godfather is
this guy who thought was dead, his hero.
He's here.
And I think one of the lovely things about that character too is that's Scorsese, and maybe Selznick who wrote the book, that Scorsese saying even back then there were the film fans, the people who just loved what others were creating in this very different art form.
Mm.
So overall, what do you think, score?
I love this film. I really do. I'm giving it a 9.
9 for me too, actually.
I thought we'd probably agree a bit on tonight because of the quality of the films on offer and our ode to cinema, you know.
We pretty much have agreed across the three, even though I've had such a violent reaction to the director's cut of Paradiso.
Yes.
But I think this is absolutely right up there. My little kind of gripe about it is that it's not quite a kid's film, and yet it kind of feels like it should be. But the way it's produced, you know, the craft there, the references that work, they don't kind of jar in the story. They work, whether it's directly quoting, you know, using scenes from the old silent films or referencing them through the clock for safety last.
That's right.
I love all that. It's a geek's paradise.
It is.
When you talk about film geeks.
This geek's paradise.
Yeah, and I think so much more for you than for me because you have that deeper pre-knowledge. But I get it, and I love it, and it was such a sumptuous film. I remember the experience, seeing it in 3D initially. It's just... It's just something slightly artificial about it, or something.
It came out the same year as The Artist,
which I didn't love. I know a lot of people did.
Yeah. So I love The Artist. I'm a big fan of that, of the silent film era as well. I'm a big fan of it. I love it. So, of course, I'm going to love this recreation, and I thought they did really well with it. So I was completely in a geek's paradise that year, you know. The Artist and Hugo are both celebrating the beginnings of movies. Mm. But
Hugo was nominated for Best Film, wasn't it? But did The Artist win that year?
The Artist won that year.
Because Hugo won lots of technical awards. He won four different technical awards. Yeah. And you can absolutely see why.
And Jean
Renoir, the actor in The Artist.
Yes, won Best Actor that year.
Mm. Whereas I think Ben Kingsley did a superb job. And for child actors, particularly the boy, you know, were very, very good, very believable and mature.
And there's one sequence I really loved in Hugo. And that's when Tabert brings the film to Georges Méliès' home.
Oh, yes.
And the wife of Georges Méliès, who's actually...
Helen McCrory, yeah.
Quite wonderful in the movie.
And really low down in the billing when she did such a great job in that film.
She does an amazing job in that film and in the recreations and everything. But when she sits there and watches the past and when you see that film...
That she's in,
and she's rewatching it, and it's.
And then Méliès himself comes out.
I've heard of an old sound of a film projector, you know, sounds like. It's just wonderful. And now with Kodak, and now bringing out, there's been such a big push to bring back film now and for young filmmakers to use film. Kodak are now bringing out, at the end of this year, a new Super 8 camera. Yeah, which is quite wonderful. And so it's going to prompt a lot of people to get back to using the medium.
Well, you know, what goes around comes around. It's a bit like how records have come back too.
Yes, that's right. There's such a richness in film, in the quality of film, that's just not there digitally. But, you know, that's why it's coming back. So that concludes series one of our Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
Woohoo!
Thank you so much for listening.
We've had a ball. Going back and watching films, coming here and engaging in the conversation, and we hope you're picking up on the relationship, the deep friendship and respect that Ricardo and I have for each other, even though we don't always agree.
Mm-hmm.
And on some films we certainly haven't agreed, including today. But it's been an absolute hoot, and we hope some of that joy is infectious and coming across.
Look, if you want to please just... if you've got any comments on the films or you want to...
or just point out how I've been right and Ricardo's been wrong. Yeah, you know, not please really. Do.
But if you want to offer some suggestions, maybe for series two for us,
films, themes,
whatever, we'd love to hear from you. So please, you know, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Their handles at @FMakerFWatcher for our Twitter, or follow us on Facebook. So yeah, and please join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you.
So I just wanted to round out the season, Ricardo, by looking back at what we've talked about and watched, you know, this season. Are there any scores that you've given that you want to revisit?
You know, I was looking back at that because I know you sort of wanted me to do that, and I think I've marked everything the way I would mark them. I don't think I'd change anything, any of my scores at all.
I changed one. When we reviewed early on The Bicycle Thief, Thieves, and I gave it a 7, and part of my critique was that the version I watched, there was so much missing from the subtitles that I felt like I didn't know what was going on. Well, I went and found a version with much better subtitles, and I got a lot more out of the film. So I gave it a 7. It would be heading towards 8 and 9 for me now.
Sure.
Again, I still feel like there's bits I don't understand, but it was interesting today going to watch Paradiso, and I felt like I understood that film better because of what I'd seen about Italy at that time in its history in The Bicycle Thief. So and if we look back at what films we saw this season, but I'm really glad that we saw and discussed, certainly Bicycle Thief's there because it's a whole genre that I hadn't been aware of. I'm pleased that I finally got forced to watch Bicycle Thieves, forced to watch Psycho.
And Cliffhanger.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's move right along.
Yeah.
And one of my absolute joys this time around is that you had never seen what is one of my absolute favourites, It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, I was going to
say, we both gave it a 10. I was so rapt when you did.
Well, that was, in terms of the films, which I'm really happy I've seen now, would be It's a Wonderful Life, Vertigo, and Rashomon.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes, I forgot about Rashomon.
Yeah.
And the film that I probably never would have sat down to watch, even though I had bought a copy, The Kids Are All Right.
Mm.
I think I would have looked at that and thought, one day. And I really enjoyed it. And I can see myself at some stage going back to watch it again.
Yeah, that's right.
So that kind of discovery. And there are films that, you know, help me discover that, quite frankly, great. And, Cliffhanger comes to mind.
Yes.
And there's some that you and I have certainly disagreed on. And Cabaret and Big Lebowski come to mind there.
Well, you chose possibly one of the worst Bond films. To show me pre-Daniel Craig, so thank you very much for that.
It wasn't what I remembered, is my excuse. You see, I'm meeting you in the middle, and maybe you can learn from that for next season.
Okay.
But to you, our audience,
look,
thanks. We hope you've enjoyed the ride as much as we have, and please come again.
Yeah, and we'd love your feedback. Love to hear from you as well on all social media platforms. But thank you very much.
I feel like we should sing or cry or something.
No. Till series two.
Next time.